EMS on the Mountain is an entertainment, educational, and commentary product recorded by Sean and Mike and produced by them. Nothing recorded by Sean, Mike, or any of the guests of the show is endorsed nor authorized by their respective employers or agencies unless explicitly outlined. All commentary and statements made are their own. Always follow your respective medical protocols. Nothing said on this platform should be considered medical direction. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the EMS on the Mountain podcast, a show for those interested in austere and wilderness medicine. This podcast provides insight into the unique aspects and challenges of bringing modern EMS into wilderness and austere environments.
Shut up, Sean.
It's a little disappointing for you.
So, I'm a bad person.
You are.
Welcome.
I don't know why we keep doing this. Anyway, for those of you used to this show, this is another traditional intro, and welcome back to another episode, EMS on the Mountain. Today, we're definitely going beyond the mountain, or above the mountain, as it will be.
Ooh.
Yeah, I like that.
Nailed it.
And we do have a special guest with us today, but basically we're going
to talk— our first ever, right?
Our first special guest?
First ever guest? Have we ever done a guest before? I can't remember.
We have.
We've done several.
Yeah. Holy shit. I'm an idiot.
Yeah, I'm an idiot. It's early.
We usually do a couple a year. Holy crap. Good job, Mike.
I suck at this.
Our former guest, I apologize for Mike's lapse in memory, and he calls me the old one.
It was a geezer moment.
Right. Anyway, so we're going to talk about austere care in a different environment today. Mike had himself a little bit of an adventure, and he's brought on a friend who was there with him to share and talk about this. So with that, Michael, why don't you lead us into this bit of shenanigans you got yourself into?
All right, then. So it turns out a provider for an agency I work for and I were on the same flight going to a place to do a thing. And it had nothing to do with EMS per se, but the quintessential, oh my God, if there are medical personnel on the plane, come to the back of the plane immediately, or something very similar was said on the PA. I, in my stupor, as I was about to be asleep with head on the wall in the most uncomfortable position ever in the middle of an airplane, stood up and began making my way. And my good friend Emma, who is here with us, was also on the plane. And so I'm going to let Emma tell the story. And then we've got some tidbits and some learnings that I learned. Sean, of course, knows everything. So he knew everything that I was like, oh, that's so interesting and neat. And Sean was like, you're an idiot. You should have known that. You're a moron. But nonetheless, Emma, why don't you tell the story of what happened and what went down?
Well, I was further back in the plane. I think I had an aisle seat, but I sit in the back of the plane because I take cheap tickets always. And I like to be back where the happenings are. So I'm sitting there in the back. I don't know if it's worth the context, but there's some really big event in the area. And it seemed like everyone on the plane was all coming from this event. So everybody's wearing like the hats and the shirts and everything.
I'll say it. It was the day after the inauguration.
Yep. It was a Republican con in town and everybody showed up. And everybody on the plane was for that. And it's not particularly relevant right away, but and even later, it's not that relevant. But I'm sitting on the plane. This guy starts walking down the aisle. He stumbles a little bit and takes a few steps. He stumbles again. He falls down. I was like, whoa.
Professionally, we call that he fell the fuck out.
A little bit, yeah. But then he stood up and he took a few more steps. And I was like, oh, he probably just tripped. I don't know. And then he falls down again just behind me. And I was like, ooh, again? And then I'm like thinking in my head, I'm like, did he trip again? Did he pass out? He looked a little old and he didn't look so good. I was like, ah, I don't know. I don't know. And then they go, medical personnel, please. And then I see you just coming down the aisle hot. And I was like, okay, I will also get up. I guess I should be helpful, even though I was right next to the guy when he fell down. And I let the nurse behind me jump up first. So when they did request people, got up, We walked over. It was a good mess of people back there.
Shit show.
Sorry?
Shit show.
It was a so you're in an aisle, so there's no room, but we're close to the bathrooms. Drag him back a little bit. Not totally unconscious at this point. He's just like a little bit like coming around, but not talking yet, not answering questions yet. Drag him back to the galley area for a little bit more room. All kinds of water and stuff on the floor. It's gross.
You mentioned we're next to the bathrooms.
Yeah.
It's an EMS call. It has to be.
Right? There wasn't fluid on the floor before, so somebody had to make it more realistic. But we sit them up. They grab the flight attendants grab the flight kits that they have, the med kits. There's like a blood pressure cuff. That's, I think the first vital we got was a blood pressure. And it was, I think, 73 over 51, somewhere in the 70-50 range. So pretty low for a blood pressure on somebody, which was alarming. And from there, we just laid him down, put his knees up. As far as the personas who are there, there's you, who's a medic. I'm an advanced EMT and also a volunteer. And we had a hospice nurse.
Yeah. Yeah. The irony of that was so awesome.
Great.
I hold his hand as he dies for you. Thanks.
Yeah.
He was a cool guy. There's also a older woman who said she had been an RN for 40 plus years.
Yeah.
And she was
38 of those. She wasn't practicing, but she'd been an RN for 40 years.
Yeah. I was under the impression she had retired 20 years prior. I'm not sure if that's true. And then there was also this younger woman hanging around. And I go, "Hey, are you family? How can I help you?" And she goes, "Oh, I'm a doctor." And I was like, "Oh, that's great." And I was like, "What kind of doctor?" She's like, "I'm a pediatric doctor." And I said, "That's still great."
But there's two days of pediatrics. So yeah. Thank you.
I was like, "Come on, help out." See, Michael took over organizing people, telling people what to do. We tried to get some more vitals and like the clip SpO2 thing. I don't remember anything remarkable about that, his heart rate or his oxygen level. Maybe you do.
It was directionally fine. Let's use the quintessential term that everyone puts in their chart and nobody qualifies, right? He was a little tacky.
Yeah. A little tacky.
Yeah. Also in his attire and his heart rate.
A 1-2 punch right there.
Boom.
What else do we do? We tried to reposition him, get some better vitals. We're getting a blood glucose was really tricky because none of us had ever seen that variety of.
Let's talk about that. Not surprisingly, but worth note, every bit of all the equipment in the BLS bag or the first in bag or whatever the heck you would call it on an airplane, the, "Hey, this guy's not doing good. We've got to get his blood pressure" bag. Every single thing was still in the cellophane, brand new, and nobody knew how to operate any of it. So I've never seen Lancets. I've seen Lancets. I can make people bleed with just about anything. The blood glucose device is something I had never seen before, where the Lancets actually went in a we don't really publish these on YouTube, so I'm making motions with my hand. It went in at a 45-degree angle, as opposed to typical glucometers where the strip like feeds into a slot. This thing like mounted on the side, like a mini breathalyzer device almost. And then like the vacuum hole where the blood goes in was like on like a corner. It was not like on a flat side of the doodad. And so it took us like 3 or 4 tries to figure out how to put this thing together to get some blood in the damn thing. Yeah. Like, that was the hardest part of the whole thing, was the cognitive load required to make the glucometer freaking work after we took it out of the box.
And it's like, I get my panic hands, and my hands aren't shaking. I just sometimes feel like they don't do what I need them to do. It's usually when I'm like putting gloves on and it's, I should be able to do this. Why can't I get my gloves on? And I'm like, why can't I get the stupid little strip thing in this glucometer that doesn't look like, are we sure this is a glucometer? Are we sure?
Did have a momentary thought when I was like, is this a lactate meter? And then I looked at the box and was like, nope, it says glucometer. But I'd never seen one that worked that way before. There's lots of stuff in this world I've seen or never seen that I'm sure is out there.
But his glucose was good. I don't remember what it was, but it was good.
It was in the 100-somethings.
Yeah, so nothing that tells you that, okay, this is a diabetic emergency or a hypoglycemic situation. So really all we had at that point was he has low blood pressure. He looks a bit elderly. He's starting to answer questions, but not really telling us what his medical history is. Just, hey, do you know what your name is? Yeah, this is my name. Or, hey, do you know where you are? Like, I'm on a plane, but not if we asked him his medical history at first. He's, I don't have medical history, or I don't know, just overwhelmed was the impression I had.
And at this point, the retired nurse has asked him at least a dozen times, do you have any chest pain? Are you having trouble breathing? That was just it was like a robot just kept saying those words over and over. And over.
No input received. Re-asking the question.
Yeah, until eventually I was like, hey, he's good. I don't think he's having chest pain. He's not clutching his chest. But we'll find out more in a minute. Please stop asking. You're confusing me.
She was, I think.
She vapor locked too. This is not her game, right? She's not in the business of going into somebody's house and fixing an immediate problem, but she wanted to be helpful. And so she just biased back toward what she knew. And what she knew is, oh my God, if somebody kirks the fuck out, they might be having a chest or a heart attack. And so she just kept asking and asking because she couldn't mentally move on to the next question.
And the flight attendants were also, they're great, but they also didn't know what was going on medically speaking. And they were like, what do you need from us? What are we do?
Boy, did they want to help.
Grabbing bags. Should I keep handing you stuff? How about oxygen? How about this? Which was all great and really helpful to have all of that stuff coming, and very thankful for what they have to do and figure out. But it was still like, okay, we just need to take a step back.
Do you remember the one flight attendant that ran to the front of the plane and came back not once but twice with two fistfuls of gloves because she felt really needed a lot of latex gloves? So she would run to the front galley and be like, it wasn't even in a box. It was just like wads of gloves in her hands that she would throw in her general direction.
Yeah. The person I was sitting next to on the flight, he was like, yeah, I knew it was bad because people kept running by with gloves. And I was like, what kind of mess is going on back there? They keep running past with gloves. That's one indicator.
So we're 5-6 minutes into this dance. And I'm actually, watch this. I'm going to do this epic four-dimensional, tie this back to Wilderness EMS. I never really touched the patient for quite a bit. But what I did is the paramedic and the guy with the experience doing the pre-hospital things is I brought chaos to the mayhem, or I brought calm to the chaos. I calmed the mayhem.
Yeah, right? Sounds like
it. And this
it.
Actually happens.
Love running and...
You
gear
know what?
Throwing.
Hold the fuck on, Sean. Hold the fuck on.
Yeah, right? Good job.
So they're okay. So just to summarize the scene, we've got a palliative care nurse going, hey, he's not good. We've got a retired RN going, do you have chest pain? 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 We got Emma looking at me going, this is a fucking glucometer. I've never seen this shit before. And I'm standing in between the patient and the flight attendant, the other flight attendant, who's on the phone with the captain trying to talk to me simultaneously while trying to translate what the captain is saying while holding some laminated card of some sort of checklist they have to fill out and simultaneously trying to open her medical app that I'd learned all airlines have for the attendants to use in the event of an emergency. And she is trying to put demographics into this thing and talk to the patient at the same time while talking to the patient, while looking at me, while holding this laminated card, trying to read the step one. Open the app. Step two, type patient's first name. So I eventually said, hey, everybody. Like, I did not say this, but in my head, I wanted to be like, hey, everybody, shut the fuck up. Hi, my name's Mike. I'm a paramedic. What's going on today? And he said, bleh, bleh, I'm on an airplane. So I looked at the flight attendant and I said, can I just talk to the captain? And she went, no. And I think the captain overheard me because then suddenly the phone was just thrust into my face. So I said to the captain, "Hello, sir. I have no idea what's going on, but there's a patient with a very low blood pressure, and I need to do some analyses." And the pilot, I'm going to give this dude a bunch of kudos, almost like he dealt with this before and was trained for it. He was very calm and collected. He's like, "That sounds great. Can I call back in 5 minutes and we can determine whether or not we're going to divert the plane? I have about 12 minutes to make the decision between our final destination or a diverted site. I just need some input as to whether or not I need to get this plane on the ground ASAP or whether this patient can remain stable until we get to our final destination." And I was like, "That sounds like a great plan, Captain." And then he said, "By the way, we have additional medical supplies. Would you like them?" And I said, "Absolutely." And it was at this point that I learned, after handing the phone back to the flight attendant, or anyone that is in the medical profession and ends up on a plane, and this ever happens to you, there are actually FAA regulations, and I'm assuming similar international regulations, as to what equipment, Sean's nodding his head vigorously, so yes, international regulations as well, as to which medical equipment and what volume of said medical equipment needs to be on an airplane, based on, I'm assuming, number of seats. There's some sort of matrix chart thingy that says you need a number of IV catheters and X amount of fluid and yada, yada, yada. But all of that equipment is locked up, and it's actually under a lock and key in a locked box that has also got a security tag that we all know are useless. Like, you can pull this off, no problem. Serialized tag for tracking that is available on the flight for providers that may need the equipment, but is not, quote unquote, readily available for the flight crews to just pull out of a box. And the captain said, "All right, I'm going to call back in 2 minutes. I need you to talk to the doctor." And there's actually on-call medical control physicians that are contracted by the airlines to help address these situations and provide guidance from the ground. So I was put on some sort of patch from the plane to a doctor, and I explained who I was and what my credentials were. And the doctor said to the captain, "I approve. He is allowed to have access to the ALS equipment." And at that point, they hoisted a, 12 by 8, like large blue, one of those fold-out bags where the pouches keep folding open.
Yep, like a folder that keeps going.
Yeah, and she foisted this thing upon me and said, "Here, I don't know what any of this stuff is. Have fun." And so I cleared off the counter in the back galley and unrolled this thing and started taking assessment as to what tools we had. It turns out we had quite a few of them. There were 4 or 6 IV catheters in there, a couple of extension sets, bag of ringers, bag of fluid. Pretty much, I don't want to.
I got a little excited because we don't carry lactated ringers where I'm at. And last time I saw them was in class. And I was like, "Oh, I almost didn't believe they were real."
That's funny because I carry them in one of the systems I work in. Like, it's our go-to.
That almost makes me sad.
Yeah. So the stuffs came out, and at this point I started handing catheters and things to Emma, who is an ALS provider. And I said, "Hey, let's get a line on this dude. His blood pressure's in the tubes.
Got a needle first. She grabbed
it." Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Funny, because I carry them in one of the
systems. "Give me a stick. Give me a tube." And I was like, "What kind of tube? What are you talking about?"
Aggressively in that, she's like,
"Give me a catheter right now." And I was like, "Yes,
ma'am." Yeah.
Did the first attempt, I think. I'm not sure.
We effectively rooted around this dude's skin and poked a lot of holes in him, is what happened. But like, we as a combined crew of people did a lot of rooting around. That's about as much as we got done.
I think around this time, too, nephew, son, family of some variety came down the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to ask him, "Hey, what kind of medical history does this guy have?" I think he had some basic American cardiac history, but nothing serious.
He's over 50, so he's on, cholesterol medication and blood thinners. And he had some sort of minor cardiac history, but
it wasn't anything super crazy, and I don't remember what it was.
No, but the big kicker that I remember hearing, and I remember looking at, I think the nurse, someone at some point, he was on metoprolol.
Yes.
And this is often not talked about in EMS, but I'm going to bring it up here. If you have a patient that's in a bad way with a low blood pressure and stuff, but they don't seem tacky or they're not rocking 160 beat heart rate, that's not because they don't want to. It's because they can't. And a lot of people miss that step, right? "Oh, he's not that bad. Like, his blood pressure is a little soft, but his heart rate's not up." His heart rate's not up because he's taking medication that artificially suppresses his heart rate. At this point, I made notes because now we've got some skin exposed and we're looking at the dude. I asked somebody to do a full trauma assessment because he was bleeding from the head. He was bleeding from his face. He was
his nose and his chin.
Yeah, he was gray. Like, he was not perfusing really well. So I knew that we were going down the, this is a perfusion problem route. Could be his heart that's not moving the blood around, but at a minimum, like, we got to bolster this dude.
Yep. So we're talking to this family member, like, what's been going on for the past few days? And they had come into town for the big event, and dad or the uncle, our patient, was not feeling well, maybe had norovirus, hadn't been able to keep down any food or fluid for a few days, was not going to miss the event, stuck around, attended the event, was outside all day long for said event, out and about, was flying home, still hadn't had anything to eat in a few days.
And if you're listening to this podcast in the future at some point, I just want to remind everyone that the 2024 inaugural event, it was cold AF in the district. Like, it was cold.
25.
Sorry, 25. I said 24. Math is hard for me. I should do med math on a regular basis. Yeah. Like, it was cold in DC, like, uncharacteristically cold. And he'd been out in it all day.
But everybody who came to attend was still waiting outside, just watching stuff happen from out and about. Dedicated individual, not eating outside, difficult environment, which starts to explain that low blood pressure.
So as the team is attempting to, we got his legs up and we're trying to do things to bolster and bolster his blood pressure a little bit. They're still working on getting a line. I took inventory of what was in the bag and I went, oh, cool. We've got Epi 1-1000 in ampules. And so I set out to MacGyver something out of the bag because they had ampules, but they did not have filter straws. So there were draw needles in the bag, but there were not filter needles or filter straws in the bag. So I MacGyvered as best I could. I used a 27 or a 25 gauge. They had like a tiny little catheter thingy in there. For, it looked like a pediatric sort of tool that I'd not seen. It looked almost like a straight stick needle, but it was really tiny.
Like a tiny hypodermic needle.
I put a little extension set on that thing and used that to draw the 1-1000 epi into a syringe. And then I diluted it with saline. And then I diluted it again to make cardiac epi. So I made cardiac epi. I took the 1-1000, made 1-10,000. And then I took 1 cc of that and mixed that again in a separate syringe to make push presser epi. So that if we could get a line, I could potentially give this guy a little bump and help his constriction as well, as long along with just the volume we were trying to get on board.
And you asked me to follow along with your math while you were doing it, which is a great practice. And I was, again, much like the lactated ringers. Oh, I have not done this a lot since class, but everything tracked, multiplying by 10 or 100.
Even 10. We could do that.
I can follow along with that.
But it was my first experience in trying to make push presser epi from a 1-1000 vial without the right, or ampule, excuse me. It did not have a rubber top. All of it was for naught because it turns out we could never get a line that would stick around and hang out for very long. But we were ready, man. We were ready.
I think after we didn't get the first two lines and we had his legs up, his blood pressure did start to come up a little bit. And I recall the call being that let's just hold off. And if he gets in a bad way, we could be more aggressive with an IV again. But
yeah, and I'll just be honest with our listeners and you, like, I strongly encourage that executive decision because I was watching people just poke the fuck out of this guy. And we weren't making progress. And I was like, let's just pause on the IV thing. Everyone seems to be really fixated on the IV thing, not fixated on the state of the patient. Maybe we can take some more BLS-esque maneuvers here, like raising his legs and whatnot to do this. We don't have to get an IV at this moment. He's still moving air around and we're not pushing on his chest yet. Behind the scenes mental thoughts, like, I'm watching people just like sewing needle this dude's arm. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to be effective. Let's pause that activity for a minute. He ended up getting a little better, laying down on the, as I mentioned, moist galley floor next to the toilet. It was super awesome for him. But his mentation started coming back. He was able to talk to us a little more. So we sat him up. it was around that time that I got on the phone with the pilot. I said, I think we're going to be good to go. He was like, I got to make a decision in the next 2 minutes, whether or not we're going to divert or whether we're going to go to our final destination. Because time-wise, they have to do the math in the air and be like, that airport's 22 minutes away. Our final destination is 27 minutes away. Can we just make it 6 minutes and go to our final destination and not screw up everybody else's life and without having an appreciable impact for the patient? So we proceeded on to our final destination. At that point, the flight crews were nice enough to kick everyone out of their seats in the back of the plane. And we put him in a middle seat and continued to monitor our patient for the 20 some odd minutes that was the duration of the flight. And then I was expecting an airport EMS crew.
3 minutes and that we gave him some water. So
yeah, you're correct. And we gave him Zofran, but I was just skipping over all of those important details. He did feel a little nauseous. Fall down, go boom. He did lack his chin pretty good. He had a little lack in his head. He banged himself up in the fall. At first he was like, I just want to go home. And then I reminded him that he hit his head. And what did your doctor tell you when they put you on these medications? And he was like, I should get a CT scan. Like, that's correct, sir. You should. Again, I was expecting an EMS crew of some sort to come on the plane. And the pilot is preparing everyone on the plane for, everyone stay in your seats. The EMS providers are going to step on the plane. We're going to get this guy off first. And like one cop came walking down the aisle. Now, he's an ALS provider of some sort. Or is a medical practitioner of some sort. He was a law enforcement officer. Nice guy. Like, he seemed nice. He could speak the lingo with me. And Sean, he had one of those SOAR aluminum bag hanger thingies that we have in our kit. I forget what they're called. The Scorpion, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
I noted he had a scorpion in the molly on his chest, on his plate carrier.
That's how you know he was a badass.
I didn't want to make fun of him, but at least I knew that he knew, or somebody handed it to him. It was one of the two. But I had to go on the assumption that he had some sort of medical training, because he's walking around with a tool used to hang bags in less than ideal situations. But he talked to the patient for a minute, and he was like, all right, can you walk? And they just walked him off the plane, and we went on about our lives and did our thing.
God damn heroes.
Forgot to hear.
I deserve a challenge coin.
The nurse, the RN, was the one who started the round of applause for.
Oh, that's right. She did get the whole plane to clap for us.
Yeah.
But she started it. Nobody was clapping. And then she started it. I was like, this lady.
I want people to clap for me. That's terrible.
Yeah, I wanted to punch her in the face. But
I am pretty slow to anger, I think. But she was driving me crazy, especially when she kept patting my head with her like dirty glove damp hand, like on my freshly washed hair, and say, oh, sweetheart, I'll be praying for you. I'll be praying for you, sweetheart. I'm praying for all of us. I'm praying for him. I'm a praying person myself, but I don't want dirty gloves in my hair. I really don't.
Cool. Can you go to your seat and do that? Thanks.
She was in the row behind me, like reaching over the seat.
Oh, yeah. That's the best.
I was like, okay.
Yeah. She was quite something, if you will. So that's the gist. Here's some of my key takeaways. One, and this does not apply to airplanes, but it seems like a great opportunity to observe some of these things and talk about them. I don't want to say we don't see it. And this really does, this feels like it really applies to the wilderness context quite a bit. There's often when somebody falls down, goes boom, there's a whole bunch of people that really want to help. Mm. And it reminds me, Sean, of the waterfall event where the two girls pitched. Yeah. And there was like 47 people there that wanted to be helpful, and not a damn one of them knew what to do.
No, one of them did.
Fair, fair. And she was awesome.
And yes, and you put her to work.
I did.
Yeah.
But she was an EMT. She was a trained EMT that rode on a truck and knew, heck, she had a blood pressure cuff in her backpack while hiking on a Saturday afternoon.
She did.
And it wasn't even a blood pressure cuff. It was one of the auto cuff thingies with the button and the batteries and the stuff. She had that thing with her because it was important in the woods. I applaud her for that.
Yeah.
But what I'm leaning at here is I got thinking about it after we were on the plane. It's actually pretty rare most of the time that like some mayhem doesn't occur where there aren't already bystanders there. Mm-hmm. And it was a good reminder for me that like one of my jobs is the quote unquote senior or more learned provider, because I'm not going to say I'm better at anything than anybody else. I'm just the guy with more schoolings. It's my job to bring calm to the chaos. It's not just my job to leap into the fray and start doing work. And that's actually a very good practice for a paramedic in general, because I'm starting to get on board with the stuff that's floating around the social media. There's no such thing as BLS and ALS. There's like immediate life intervention stuff. And then there's some additional things we could do to make things not be so bad. But basic life support isn't basic. It's, you know, fundamental life support. Do the simple things. Raise his legs. Get him some water. Talk to him. Find out his medical history. These are all things I don't have to do as a paramedic. I just need a partner or a member of the crew that is conscious and capable of doing so. And that's actually way more important than rooting around in some dude's arm for an IV. Mm-hmm. We need to know, like, what we need to understand the situation we're trying to mitigate. And that is not a paramedic level skill. That's good provider level skill. So it's not always my job. And I'm not saying people always do this, but there's multiple people there. It's my job to make sure that we're progressing and moving forward toward some sort of definitive response to the emergency, not just do stuff. And yeah, oftentimes, gets overlooked in school, right?
I think having a leader is so critical in these calls. And it's interesting that we did mention that there was a doctor there. And so being a leader doesn't always fall to the most booked person, the most schooled person. It's the person who knows how to talk to people, pull people around, ask the right questions, tell people, no, stop doing that. Like that, it's not just medical understanding at that point. You have to be able to, as you said earlier, bring calm to the chaos. And I think you did that really well in that scenario, but.
Aw, thanks. There's time for everything.
I think that that segues into the studies that have been done about paramedic-led out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, vice hospital-led, and that the better run codes are generally paramedic-led. Even if they're in an ED, if a paramedic's leading the code, they generally run better. And there's a couple of studies out there that have proven that. And it's part of it's just because in the hospital, they run a yearly drill and it's not as practiced as it is by those of us on the outside. But it's one of those things that the paramedic brings is these are the things we must do. And this is the order that we should be doing them in. So let us do those, right? Get on compressions. Let's at least start bagging with some oxygen. And then once we got that going for a couple of minutes, we can then adjust, move to an advanced airway, whether that's some sort of supraglottic or an actual intubation, get our initial access, try to get that first dose of epi on pretty quick, and then move on, right? And I was talking with this with a couple of nurses the other day, and they both agreed that when you have a code in a hospital, there's suddenly two physicians, four or five plus nurses, a couple of techs, like all these people suddenly rush in there. And there's a doctor that knows, I want to give these meds, but there's nobody that's like guiding who should be doing what. What do we need to be focusing on right now? Because everybody has their little specialty. Like the RT dude walks in and it's airway, move out of my way, right? Let me do my tube because I'm an RT. This is just what I do. I'm not touching the rest of this. And everybody's looking at the docs to do stuff and they're just looking at it going, should we do epi? Should I pick this antiarrhythmic? Oh, we should get pads on. Let's see what the rhythm is real quick. And it's a bit more chaotic and it's not as efficient as they found pre-hospital folks doing, especially when you look at certain systems that really train for that choreographed cardiac arrest response. First in unit does this, second in does this, then follow-ons do these things, right? Where you walk into an ED thing and it's like they call the code blue or whatever it is for that hospital. And people just run in, I'm part of the code crew, and they just start to do things. And so I think that's an important lesson in sometimes the best thing a paramedic can do when they first get on scene is just stand back, take in that scene, identify those things that need to get done, and start getting them done. Whether they have to do it themselves or they have help, they can start doing the things for them. And I think that's a really important thing, regardless of your.
I think you nailed that. It also wasn't lost on me that, or I shouldn't say it wasn't lost on me. I realized this later. Thought about it, right? When we're riding a truck or in the wilderness environment that Sean and I predicated this podcast on a number of years ago, it's a little bit different. As I mentioned, there's usually people there wanting to help, but not necessarily making a market improvement, but they're doing their best, right? Oh, I was hiking too, and Timmy fell down. Let me put a cold compress on your neck or whatever. That's great. Thank you. We appreciate your help. But this this didn't even, I don't want to use the term rattle me. Like, I was almost, this is going to sound horrible, but I was almost a little pissed off that like I stood up, right? There was just one moment in my head when I saw three or four people standing there as I walked to the back of the plane. And I was like, do I even need to be here? It's fine.
Yeah.
I can play my seat. But everybody else is freaking out. Like the whole plane's like, oh, that guy fell out. And there's, what's going on? There's a bad thing. And we've been doing this so long. It's Tuesday. Huh. Like, what medical problem am I going to intervene on today?
Is he breathing?
Right.
Oh, yeah, he's breathing. Oh, okay, cool. Let's slow down a minute then. Yeah.
But I also very much want to point out that we should not allow the repetition and that sort of attitude to creep in. Yeah, this guy probably just, his blood pressure dropped. Maybe his sugar dropped a little bit. He's syncopized. He passed out, caused him to do this thing called not standing. Not standing results in you falling down, results in you hitting your head because there's like things to hit your head on. And we moved on from there. But it could have been a completely different problem or something I'd never seen before. And not allowing yourself to get, I felt bad because I allowed myself a little bit in the beginning to be like, this is a normal bullshit call. Like, take me on to the boat. And then I snapped out of it and was like, wait a minute. There's kind of chaos going on here. There's a bunch of people saying things, but nobody's actually focused on the problem. And I just focused on bringing the calm to the event. Moved on from there.
I think, and this is, and before I go on this, I won't call it a rant, but this next piece, my nurse friends, take no offense to this. You know who you are, and those that know what's going on will certainly agree with me. So when it comes to having other providers on scene, like you had Emma, an advanced EMT, you knew her. It's okay. I know what your skill level is. I know what you're capable of doing. I can put you to work. But when you have those randos, I'm a nurse. I've been a nurse for 20 years. It's cool. Where do you work? If you've worked in the peds ward for 30 years and you work in labor and delivery, it's great. You're a nurse. You have foundational good medical knowledge. But this is so far out of your scope that you're almost not helpful at certain points, right? You can be in the way more than you can be helpful. Same with physicians. I'm a doctor. Cool. What are you a doctor of? Ophthalmology. Super. I'll let you know if something's sticking out of his eye, right? And again, this is nothing negative against any of these professions. Like I've admitted many times, I would love to be a nurse, but I cannot be a nurse. I do not have the patience for it. God bless every one of you. Even in the ED, I just don't have the patience to deal with patients. So if you're one of these other providers, and I'll just put this out for the folks listening, whether you've been through a wellness first aid course, woofer, EMT, whatever it is, through physician level provider. If you have no idea what you're really planning to do in this scene, and you've got like a paramedic there, maybe you should just like, hey, I'm a doc, but this is what I do. I'm going to let you go with this. If you want some advice or something, I'm here. Or if I see something, maybe I'll make a comment. And you're like, oh, great, cool. Thanks. Appreciate that. Know what, and then understand, you recognize what you don't know. And I'm just about every EMS provider in the world has always run, and it's always a cliche. It's always in the memes. But you're on scene. I'm a nurse. How can I help? It's cool. Stand over there. Like Mike and I had that traumatic arrest years ago, the motorcycle kid. Two very nice nurses who so wanted to help, but it was so obvious that this was not going to go anywhere. We did what we were required to do. I'm not saying we didn't not try to do stuff, but it was so very obvious. There's a traumatic arrest in a remote location. CPR's already been going on. Essentially, we could have rolled up, just put on the four lead, done the minimums, and then called for the confirmation of death thing. We didn't have to go
through. There was nothing we were doing.
Yeah, we didn't have to go through any of the motions. But these two nurses, and again, very well-intentioned, but just could not recognize that this was not a situation that was going to get better by doing anything. They're like, want things. And it's cool. Like the other cardiac arrest we had with a guy driving the Jeep. This guy was driving his
Jeep.
Man,
we pushed on him for CPR.
My favorite, though, is the nurse yelling for the Mac 3. She kept wanting a Mac 3. She wanted like a laryngoscope handle with a Mac 3 on it without thinking about an ET tube and everything else that goes with it. But man, yeah. She wanted a Mac 3. And everyone's, the hell do you want with that? Like, A, unless you tell me you're a flight nurse, intubation is probably outside your scope, but it is what it is. Some places, some nurses have it hospital-wise, depending on where they work. Mm-hmm. Generally not. And then when you hold up a supraglottic airway and they look at you and go, what is that? Then you have to really start questioning, what the hell are you doing? Which I gave mm-hmm. my favorite answer, or Mike's favorite answer ever, is, you don't know what this is? Get the fuck off my scene. Mike proceeds to place the advanced airway and start working airway. Life was great. And again, nothing against the nurses, but it's like, if you're not an ED nurse or maybe an ICU nurse, especially if you work flight, awesome. You've got some of that scene experience and the training for it. But man, if you've been a peds nurse or you haven't practiced in forever, like you did 6 years on the floor and then you started teaching at the local community college for a nursing program for the last 15 years, just do the normal bystanders. Hey, I'm a nurse. I'm not active practicing, but if you need some help, I'm right here. Excellent. Don't try to force yourself in, is basically what I'm saying.
And on this situation, I think the hospice nurse was really great at that. And maybe it's because they operate outside of a hospital in people's homes. They're used to working outside of kind of that doctor tells me what to do. I have my protocol mm-hmm. for this floor, this suite. He was really great about just helping and following through on things that needed to be done and not stepping on anybody's toes and trying to change the direction of what the evaluation was, but asking good questions. Oh, hey, what if we put his knees up? Great mm-hmm. question. Let's do that. But so I thought he did a really great job of that. So there's kind of a good contrast there of somebody who was very talkative, not so helpful, and then somebody who was just quietly helping out.
Yeah, see, and that's really exactly what I'm talking about. So they know where they're at. And it's, oh, hey, what if we try to elevate the feet, try and get some blood back into the torso? Oh, yeah, good idea. Let's try that. Hey, working. Great. Yeah, it's like just helping. But it's like when you get the ones that really try to like, we need to whatever. And it's, do we? Like, why? Because I just think we should. It's like, cool. Please stand over here. I'll let you know if we need some help.
I was on house once and it worked.
Yeah. So again, and again, this is providers. I don't care if you're an EMT or a paramedic. I've come across a couple of accidents on the roadway, or I've been there, witness it, and I'm there before EMS gets there, and they get there and it's give my rundowns. Hey, look, I'm a paramedic at X jurisdiction. Is there anything I can help you with? And they're like, oh, no, we got him in. Cool. And then I'll just step back out of the way. I'm not going to keep trying mm-hmm. to like, hey, you need intubate. Hey, C-spine, you guys got to get C-spine.
No. So it's funny you mentioned.
It's like, I offer, let them know who you are. Like, can I help? Is there anything you need? No? Cool. I'll be over here. And I can just step back out of the way.
Funny aside, I guess. After we landed, the plane landed, the cop came out, all that, I walked down the aisle behind the patient. So we're in the last row. Mm-hmm. The deputy or the officer led the path down the aisle, right? All the patrons were told to remain in their seats. Nobody get up. Don't try to get your luggage. AKA sit the fuck down. So the cop.
They'd seated. I was shocked.
Yeah, they all did. I was very proud of them.
Yeah.
The cop walked down the aisle in front of the patient. And I said, I'm going to walk behind you and make sure that once you stand up, if you get woozy, like I'm here to catch you.
Yeah.
But my stuff's in the back of the plane still. So we get the gentleman off the plane, link up with a couple of folks on the, one of those things called the Skyway or whatever, the tunnel you walk to get in the plane. And then I said my goodbyes and stepped back into the airplane. But now I'm stuck in the galley at the front of the plane next to the pilot, like waiting for the entire group of people to get off the plane. So I go back and get my luggage, get my stuff and go on with my day. And this one woman came by and she's, I don't remember exactly what she said, but she said one of the flight attendants, like, oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I was like, and the flight attendant just looked at me and goes, she's a paramedic from Phoenix, but she saw the situation was handled. So she just let me know that she was available if we needed her, but she went back to her seat.
See?
And I was like, yeah, perfect example of what you're talking about.
Exactly. Oh, things look like they're good, but people know I'm available if more help is needed. See, that's good.
Yeah. Now, I will say, the rules are a little fuzzy in mm-hmm. some of this, doing ALS things in the sky. I will tell all of you what I did to address the problem, or the, it's not a problem, but I felt that you don't get taught the rules for this one in paramedic school, right? You get taught write a chart.
Yeah.
follow your local agency's regulations. Well, I didn't have a name of a doctor. I didn't have nothing. But I wasn't worried about it, but I felt like I should document it. So all I did is write it up, and then I sent an email to my medical director that said, hey, by the way, this happened in an airplane between where we were and where we were going. Just so that there's a record of this, should anyone come up with it in the future, I wanted to make you aware, Mr. Medical Director guy, whose license I operate under, that these events occurred. So if any questions come up, you are not sidelined. I don't know if that's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, but at least I now have a written record of things that occurred so that if there's any question in the future, it can be referred to. So this happens to anybody on the listening out there, especially if you're operating in the U.S. under the model of operating under a physician's order sort of thing. I would recommend just writing a document somewhere so that there's a time-stamped record of the events, just so that you can refer to it, because this is outside the normal world of how we do charts and where they get uploaded and go into state systems and all of those things.
Yeah. And I would say with that too, I would probably collect names of the two primary flight attendants that were with you.
We should have done that. I had the patient demos. I had his name, date of birth, things
Kevin,
like that.
That's good.
But I didn't get other people.
Them, because then they can attest to the providing of the equipment and other stuff. If you ever did get subpoenaed for that kind of weird thing, it's like, and by the way, here's the two names of the flight attendants. You should talk to them because they're the ones that, you know, might have different recollections of contacting the pilot and supplying the gear and whatever it is.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for making me feel like a failure. I appreciate that.
Hey, I'm just... It's easy to quarterback once the game's over, dog, right?
Honestly, I was so overwhelmed by thinking about, what am I allowed to do? What do I do? I didn't really know. And that was a big reason why I hesitated to get up at first. Because I was like, I don't know. What can I do? What am I allowed to do? Good Samaritan laws cover BLS care. Am I allowed to do anything else? What can I do? What am I allowed to do? I don't know. And everybody hesitates to talk about this because it's right. It's a legal issue. And everybody goes, no, I'm not going to give you legal advice. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an attorney. Here's an article with really vague stuff about really vague stuff that's not legal advice. Here's a question I asked in class at one point. The teacher told me what she would do, but said, maybe think about it for yourself and make your own decision because I'm not a lawyer. This is not legal advice.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of vaguely written resources online, and I hadn't read them before, like from Manful down to Me Decide to Get Out of My Chair. Couldn't do much research then, but I was really worried about it. And I'm an overthinker. I think that was my takeaway from the call is that I overthink too much. And well, there's a longer tangent there that I don't need to get to.
Sometimes you just got to get in there and crack the chest, Emma. Sometimes you just got to do what's got to be done.
Usually they charge me when I talk to them about it. Usually they're therapists, but it was tricky. And since the airline, I've read about that there are acts that protect people from operating within their scope on a plane with good intentions. Unless there's gross negligence, you're going to be fine for the most part, is what I understand. And again, not legal advice. I'm not an attorney, et cetera. But it's something that I wish I knew more about beforehand.
Yeah, say that's the tricky part with the airplanes because, they have a contracted medical control, but they don't produce technically protocols. Like, here's what you're allowed to do on this airplane. It's here are the supplies we have. If it's within your scope of practice, you may use these things. Right. Mm-hmm. And then I think the thing that you got to worry about then is, I don't know, I don't think they have these. I've not seen it on any list anywhere. But what if there's the ability to do a chest tube and you got motivated as a paramedic and put in a chest tube? But it's technically not quite within a paramedic's scope of practice. A finger thoracostomy, yes. Chest tubes, generally not on the national standard anyway. And so then it's, have you been trained, certified? Like, assuming there was some sort of harm caused to the patient, right? Because you need to have the harm for anything serious to happen. You need to be aware of not just necessarily what your local authorizations are for you as a paramedic, but nationally. Like, you do need to know when to stay in your box and operate within, we'll call it your comfort zone. Like, if there were some advanced equipment, there are certain jurisdictions where a baseline paramedics don't intubate, right? Supraglottic airways is in their scope of practice and not below that. And so you have to be an advanced practice or critical care paramedic to do an intubation. But if there are intubation supplies and you're like, oh, I'm a paramedic, I can intubate, and it all goes well, great, good on you. Technically, it's within your scope. You didn't violate any laws because you're not operating under your jurisdiction's medical director at this point. It's, you're over a whole nother states and airspace and crazy weird things. So
yeah.
I think it's, you just need to understand what your personal limits are and where you need to stop. And then again, as you mentioned, if I stay within the good intentions piece and I didn't intentionally try to do something that's outside of my scope or I've never been trained on and things like that, then generally speaking, you're probably going to be fine, even if there's a negative outcome.
I was very worried to cross the line into doing any ALS skills. Mm. Like I never actually did an IV attempt. There were so many people doing IV attempts. I was like, I will let one of them.
Yeah, maybe you should have, and you might have had one.
Yeah, not myself. And I feel badly about that. I thought about it looking back, like, if he was in worse condition, would I have been more ready to jump in and not be selfishly thinking about what if I get a nasty gram from somebody about doing something when I was on an ambulance? And I have to figure that out. Like, how much am I, like, thinking about myself and the legal repercussions? If this patient was sicker, would I have been more willing to do anything? I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah. Yes, it is a very interesting situation because, you're essentially helping as a good Samaritan, bystander, responder, who is also a licensed provider at a certain level. Well, at least for us in the EMS field. And so, it's what crosses the line in this scenario? Yeah, those are all.
I don't carry lactated ringers at home. If I put the lactated ringers on, is that bad?
Nah, you'd be all right. Lactated ringers. That would have been my first choice for that guy. But yeah, here's something for Mike. When you got the big bag of toys, what are some things you, besides just some standard IV access and a few meds, do you remember what else was in there?
Okay. Yes. Quite a bit of stuff. Lidocaine Bristol jets. There were no epinephrine Bristol jets, but there was lidocaine. I found that interesting. Flushes, start kit, tegaderm, all the things that you would expect to find. There was a thousand bag of saline, 1,000 bag of ringers. There were 2 D50 ampules in there, so no D10. I had a whole plastic box full of drugs. It would be a normal complement, if you will, other than narcotics. So there were no controlled substances in there, but there was Toradol, IV Zofran, oral Zofran. I don't think there was Amio in there. There was over a dozen vials in there.
Yeah.
And then there was a separate container with 4 little ampules of Epi. I think there were 4 vials of Zofran and 3 or 4 vials of Toradol. I guess I'd call it a pretty standard ALS kit. IV needles. There were straight stick needles in there as well, as I mentioned earlier. I guess we're given blood. But the other thing I will mention is there was an entire 8.5 by 11 laminated card, and all the pouches were color-coded. They handed me the card and said, here's the stuff in there. I don't know what these words are.
Yeah.
But there was a map, if you will, of these things for this purpose that you will need for this function are in this colored pouch. So go to this colored pouch and pull the contents out. So it was actually well organized and clearly brand new in the box. Nobody's ever gone through it. They buy these things from someone, I'm guessing, that builds them for them. All the drugs were super in date at expiration dates into 2027. There was nothing that brought me pause. There was nothing. Dates on the saline bags, I think, had an early 26 date on them. Everything was brand new.
That's good.
Could just be coincidence. It's not like I go inventorying airplane ALS kits on a regular basis. And I've got to believe 99% of them are thrown out and never touched. Yeah, there were some latex gloves and
the usual collection.
The usual stuff. But I was surprised. There were a dozen vials in there.
Any airway stuff?
Medications pouch. Oh, that's a very good question. There were eye gels. Full suite of appropriately sized eye gels. No intubation supplies, which doesn't surprise me. But a full suite of eye gels for every size, which is part of the bulk in the thing. Because plastic cases,
big-ass cases
thing. Yeah, I had an entire run of eye gels in there as well for airway management.
Yeah. Something I found, it was an app that I told Mike about after he'd had this experience, which he was like, shit. And it turns out, it looks like the app is no longer available. But it was called, what, AirRx. And basically, it was for people like us, and there's an incident on aircraft, it would tell you, basically, depending on aircraft type, like if you're on international flights, things like that, and you could click on it, and it'd give you a link to what you might expect in those kits. And some of them are very comprehensive, like what Mike had. Some are a little more reduced. If you've got the small, short, 1-2 hour local flights, you're probably only going to get the small BLS kit that's just got your basic, maybe BVM, blood pressure cuff, that kind of things. And then it's on those longer flights that they have to expand to the ALS where you can actually provide some sort of care for them. I still have the app on my phone, which is handy. I don't know if it'll ever just one day make itself disappear. And I haven't tried to search. I don't remember where I found the app and how I got linked to it. I think it might have been a training course I took a couple years ago. I mentioned it. But things like that would be handy to have. If you're a provider, okay, when I ask for this kit, this is what I should expect to see so that you have some idea of what you may or may not be able to do. And worst case is it's like, all right, hey, this is what we got. Because it really doesn't matter what's on this app. What they have is what they have. And then they roll it out. And it's like, oh, okay, here's what I got to do. Here's what we got to work with. Which is good. It kind of puts you, for those of us that do the austere thing, like, oh, I have limited supplies. I really wanted this, but I don't have that. But I have this, so we're going to make this work. Having to do, like Mike was saying, prep up some push dose. Like maybe I wanted to do a norepi drip. I can't really build that, but I do have epinephrine. So I have something that'll at least get the same general thing done for me. So, but I don't know if there's any other apps that are still available that are out there that for us to see, not the flight crew, because obviously Mike mentioned, yeah, flight attendant had an app she's opening up. Like, all right, here's what I do. Here's the kit. Good luck. The only other thing I've ever heard that you might have to do for whether you're an EMS provider or physician is provide some sort of level of credential verification so that those guys on the other end can authorize you to get
into
the
good stuff.
They were asking
for the flight. I should have mentioned this earlier. They actually took pictures of NREMT cards and stuff of ours for their documentation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's some sort of process of documenting who was there and getting credential numbers and things because they wanted our registry cards. Like I had to pull up the app and open it, show it to them, and they took a picture of my phones.
Yeah. Yes, like I know that's one of those things that's mentioned. Just before on scene in a normal urban ambulance and a doc rolls up, I'm a doctor, cool, let me see something that says you're a doctor before I just let you start having at my ALS supplies with a patient. So yeah, there's supposed to be a requirement for them to verify that you indeed can access those things because you are qualified to use them. Just little bits of stuff that are out there. I used to carry, just for that purpose, a laminated paper copies of my certification cards, but I quit doing that since you can now go to the app and you can put your registry card, basically, you know, if you get an iPhone, into your Apple wallet. So, oh, yeah. Here's my National Registry paramedic card. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. Because that's really easy to verify for people.
Yeah.
A state card, it'd be much more difficult for them to Google how to verify those credentials. It is what it is. So, austere medicine at 30,000 feet. Sounds good. Anything else?
Yeah. No, we kicked ass and saved lives. Now I think I will stop the recording and we will move on with our days.
Okay, then.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, all right. You're very welcome to have been here.
Okay, bye-bye. If you have any questions or comments or ideas for show topics, you can send us an email at theshow@emsonthemountain.com or hit us up on social media. We can be found on Facebook and Instagram at EMS on the Mountain, Twitter at EMSOTM, or you can engage with us and a whole community of wilderness EMS professionals at locals.com/wilderness EMS.
Until the next episode, thanks for joining us. And until we see you on the mountain, train hard, be safe, and do good work.